Thank you for your indulgence as we try to accommodate as many people as we can in a limited space. Some of you have stuff to write on and some of you don't, but we hope you can all hear, see, sit, eat, and learn. How's that? I want to welcome you. My name's Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. And welcome you to this program to examine the Medicaid provisions in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. This is the second one in our series of briefings on the reform law. We have at least two more scheduled, each of the next two Fridays, just for your calendars. We'll be doing private insurance provisions next Friday and Medicare on Friday the 7th, I guess it is, of May, and we'd love to have you back. Now, a lot of people are describing this period as a new era, a post-reform enactment era, and our goal today is to prepare you for the next events of that era, at least in the area of Medicaid. There was an inordinate amount of debate, somewhere I would say between discussion and dyspepsia, over the so-called public option as part of reform. And while nothing with that label was part of the final package, Congress and the President quietly put in place the biggest expansion of Medicaid coverage, I guess. I wrote in my head in memory, but I think it's in history. 16 million more people, CBO estimates, will be added to Medicaid and CHIP rolls by 2019, almost a 50% increase. And that expansion accounts for almost half of the total spending in this reform law. So this is a big deal. Not only is this new law going to reshape Medicaid, but the Medicaid changes are going to have a substantial impact on the healthcare system itself. And a tremendous impact on lower-income Americans. So today's program is aimed at helping all of us learn more about exactly how that reform law and its changes are going to affect the Medicaid program. We hope to give everybody a relatively objective look at what's in there, as we say. And we're pleased to have as a partner in today's program the Kaiser Family Foundation, which has done as much good work on policies affecting low-income and vulnerable populations as anybody. My co-moderator, Diane Rowland, is not only the executive vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation and the executive director of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, she was also recently named by the Comptroller General to chair the new Medicaid and CHIP Payment and Access Commission. Those of you who are unfamiliar with the acronym MACPAC, get it in your heads. It's going to be very important over the next few years. And Diane, let me call on you at this point.
Well, thank you, Ed, and thank you all for being here. We always try to do what we call 101s on some of the major programs, Medicaid, Medicare, and private insurance. And so in that theme, we thought we should at least look at how the health reform legislation has affected all three of those programs. So we're pleased to be sharing today and the next two Fridays with Ed and hopefully with many of you to really examine what the changes in the legislation have been. We build these, though, on a 101 level. We're not hoping to explain to you what some clause on some page actually means, but instead to provide the broader framework of how the legislation is changing some of the basic operating programs. I think that it's interesting for some of us to remember when we started the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid. We called it the Kaiser Commission on the Future of Medicaid, and then we changed the title in 1996 because people kept telling us that Medicaid had no future. So I'm very pleased to be here today because Medicaid seems to have not only a future, but a very robust one and an important one. And we've got a great panel to help share some of the insights about what that future means. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. A couple of quick logistical items. In your packets, there are copies of slides. There also is a a new improved version of Cindy Mann's slides, which you should have been able to pick up. If you haven't got it, someone can give it to you. There's a lot more background information on the Alliance website in our attempt to save a few trees. We are putting a lot of the background material there instead of running it off and putting it in your packets. there is, as usual, a green card that you can use to ask a question at the appropriate time and a blue form to fill out to give us some feedback on this program to help us improve them as we go along. So you can see a webcast of this briefing on Monday through the good offices of the Kaiser Family Foundation at their website, kff.org. There'll be a transcript available in a few days on the allhealth.org website. And that is the housekeeping. Let's get to the program. We're very pleased. We have a terrific group of panelists today with a broad range of experience to give us some insight into the Medicaid provisions of the reform law. And leading off today is Robin Rudowitz. Robin's the Associate Director of Kaiser's Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. She identifies policy opportunities and oversees research and develops and writes commission publications. She's done a stint at the Lewin Group. She was Medicaid Director in the CMS Office of Legislation a while back. And speaking of back, we're happy to welcome you back. Robin?
Thanks, Ed and Diane. And thanks, everyone, for coming here today. As Diane said, I'm not going to cover every provision, certainly in the bill that relates to Medicaid, but in the next few minutes I hope to at least lay out some of the major and fundamental changes that are going to affect Medicaid that were part of health reform. So to start off with, we have this slide that really just provides a snapshot, really, of what Medicaid is today and what it might look like tomorrow. Essentially, we all know that Medicaid is really the program that provides comprehensive and affordable coverage to about 60 million low-income people in the country right now. The program is administered by the states within these broad federal guidelines, and financing is shared between the federal government and the states. Medicaid also provides assistance to Medicare beneficiaries and is the largest payer and provider of long-term care services. Health reform really builds on these current roles and enhances them for the Medicaid program by really expanding coverage, providing a significant amount of additional federal resources for that coverage, and providing coordination for the dual eligibles and also new long-term care options. Health reform, or Medicaid today, is one of the key players in the healthcare system, and certainly under health reform it remains so. Prior to the changes in health reform, individuals needed to meet both categorical and income requirements to be eligible for the program. States could expand beyond minimum federal levels, and we see from this chart that today states have pretty broad and generous coverage for children through Medicaid and CHIP, and the median eligibility level is about 235% of poverty. But coverage is really much more limited for their parents, and essentially prior to health reform, Medicaid prohibited coverage of adults without dependent children unless the state had a waiver for that coverage. So there's a lot of variation in coverage across these categories and a lot of variation in coverage across the states. Medicaid is really the foundation for providing coverage as part of health reform. Essentially, the health reform bill expands Medicaid coverage to 133% of the federal poverty level, and it essentially or effectively eliminates some of the categorical requirements for getting onto the program. 133% of poverty translates into about $14,000 a year for an individual or $29,000 a year for a family of four. On top of Medicaid eligibility levels, there's some subsidies for individuals with low to moderate incomes to access coverage in a new health exchange, and then a whole series of other changes in health reform that help make the system work, including an individual mandate and provisions for employers and changes to the insurance market, which will be covered in future Alliance meetings. We know that the new law is expected to achieve 92% coverage by 2019, and that translates into a reduction in the uninsured of 32 million people. We know that CBO estimates that Medicaid coverage is expected to increase by 16 million people, and effectively that's about half of the increase or accounts for half of the reduction in the uninsured. So just to dive a little bit deeper into some of the coverage provisions, again, Medicaid is now going to be expanded to individuals with incomes up to 133% of the poverty level. And for most states, that means a significant increase in coverage for adults on the program across the states. Again, there's additional and significant federal financing. The federal government will finance 100% of that new coverage from 2014 to 2016 and also provide some help to some states that were early leaders in expanding to adults. There's provisions to maintain current eligibility for individuals on Medicaid for adults until 2014 and for children until 2019. And states don't need to wait till the requirements to cover childless adults really take effect in 2014. There is an option for states to move ahead with coverage for this population that was effective April 1st, and some states are considering that and moving forward with that. And CMS has put out guidance on that. And just to go back for one second, and key to many of these changes is really simplifying and coordinating eligibility for both Medicaid and the exchange, which is part of making coverage more seamless across across various types of insurance. There are a number of changes to benefits for Medicaid. In 2014, when you have all these new people on the program, they will be guaranteed a benchmark benefit package. And while states have flexibility in determining that benefit package, it has to be at a minimum equal to what is going to be included in the essential health benefits that will be available in the exchange. There are some other key benefit changes that happened before 2014, including advances for smoking cessation coverage, development of an option to coordinate care better for people with chronic conditions through a new health home, and fiscal incentives to provide primary care in Medicaid as well. There's also a whole series of payment reform provisions that will affect Medicaid. As Ed mentioned before, MACPAC is now funded through the new health reform bill, and that will focus, again, on these payment and access issues with Medicaid. There's also going to be a new Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, which, along with some demonstration programs that are funded in health reform, will look at these new innovative payment and delivery reforms. And importantly, in an effort to help build provider capacity for the new Medicaid expansion, the new law includes an increase in Medicaid provider rates for primary care to the Medicare levels for 2013 and 2014. And that increase in rates is financed by the federal government, not by the states for those years. There are a number of provisions that generate some savings for the federal government in health reform related to changes in the drug rebates and disproportionate share payments, and I'm not going to get into all the details on those. I'm ahead of a slide, I think. And there are also a number of important changes and new options related to long-term care. First, there's going to be this new office that will coordinate policies for dual eligibles. And we know that these individuals are really have some of the most complex needs and are the most costly individuals for both Medicare and Medicaid. So the new office will really focus on that coordination. And there's also a few options that really increase the options for community-based long-term care services with some fiscal incentives to the states to move more people into community-based long-term care. So, to sum up, where we are now, I think, there's a lot of state budget pressure that is right now still remaining because of the recession, and it looks like that will persist for quite some time. Congress is now debating the extension of the ARRA funds, these Medicaid funds that provided additional federal financing for the states, And states are making their decisions right now about what to include and what to do in their fiscal 2011 budgets. So depending upon what Congress does, that will affect what states do in terms of provider and benefit cuts in these budgets that they're currently negotiating. And we know that these cuts right now that states are looking at could have implications for the implementation of health reform. So it'll be important to watch what Congress does. Again, we know that Medicaid will play this pivotal role in health reform with large increases in eligibility as well as major increases in additional federal revenue. And we also know that there is lots of work ahead from the administration and from the states to implement health reform. So I will turn it over to Cindy and Vern.
Very good. Thank you so much, Robin. We indeed want to welcome Cindy Mann, who's now the director of the CMS Center for Medicaid and State Operations. Excuse me, she's in charge of developing and making work all the national policy for Medicaid and CHIP and several other programs. A decade ago, Cindy ran the CHIP program at CMS and spent the period between her two HHS stints at Georgetown's Health Policy Institute, where she directed the Center for Children and Families. And it's really nice to have you back, Cindy. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here, and thank you for doing this session. Although the introduction was a little bit foreboding in terms of all the things we have to do, but we're very excited about the changes that are happening as a result of the health reform legislation and, of course, changes that we had underway even before the legislation. So let me build on what Robin's presentation provided in terms of some of the nuts and bolts of what's inside the new law as it pertains to Medicaid and talk a little bit about how we're thinking about what those opportunities are going forward. So as Robin's data show, Medicaid, Medicaid and CHIP together, employer-based coverage and the exchange really form the three legs of the stool of the promise of universal coverage for people under 65. And it is very much those three different components that will together make the promise a reality. And it is easy to think about each of them separately and all that has to be done separately. And to then lose, and it's for us, it's very easy then to think about within Medicaid, you have Section 1022 and how am I going to implement that, and Section 2033 and how are we going to implement that. And, of course, while we need to focus on that, we also need to always keep in mind the forest from the trees. And I think this stool, to me, is part of that forest, which is to we have to weave a system out of these component parts if we are to make this coverage promise a reality. So if you think about what the new legislation does, a lot of people think of in the Medicaid context, yeah, it expands Medicaid. More people will be eligible for Medicaid. But it really creates a very different paradigm if you think about it. In many respects, the law assumes that everybody will who's eligible will be covered. The notion in Medicaid that we have come to get used to, some less tolerant than others, that there are eligible but unenrolled people, that notion really is intended to go away. In the new health reform legislation, everybody is supposed to be covered. The phenomenon of churning that we have seen in public and in private health insurance, where people are on the program and then off the program and they may still be eligible and then they come back, the concept in the new paradigm is that that phenomenon ought to go away as well. And so what that means is that we really need to rethink our systems and inside Medicaid and across the three legs of that stool of how we are enrolling and renewing people and how we are marrying those systems so it truly is a system instead of three disparate component parts. We have to do that not just for the promise of universal coverage, but we have to do that because really to attain the kind of quality and cost containment goals that are also anticipated by the new legislation, we know that we need to give people stable coverage and ensure that they get primary care, preventive care, and the benefits of the law from the beginning to the end. So we need to do a lot of thinking about how to retool the Medicaid program and how to keep make a system out of the different component parts. And this just gives you a little bit of a schema. And what we're doing, certainly at the department, is thinking very much in concert with the folks who are working on the exchange and with the people in Treasury and IRS about how these systems will work together. So transitioning to a new Medicaid program means a lot of things are happening in immediately and before 2014, which is when the big expansion comes into play. As Robin mentioned, we have the early option for states to cover so-called childless adults. I say so-called because many of them actually have children. They're just children that are over 18 and in lots of different circumstances, but we collectively don't seem to have a better label for them, so we still call them childless adults. We issued guidance on April 9th about how states can exercise the option to cover these individuals, and as Robin noted, we are currently in discussions with a number of states who are considering taking up this option or revising some aspects of their current coverage in light of this option. We also just issued guidance on, I believe it came out yesterday, we had a computer problem, so it was a day late, on the drug rebate provisions in the new legislation. There will be more guidance coming out on the drug rebate provisions, which were effective in January on the, many of the nuts and bolts of exactly how it will work to implement these changes. We are looking at the new maintenance of effort provisions. The legislation, as Robin noted, sets a maintenance of effort for Medicaid in adults through 2014, very similar to what we've had in place under ARRA, so that states, as a condition of participating in the Medicaid program, eligibility standards, methodologies, and procedures aren't to change for adults in Medicaid that goes to 2014. For children in both Medicaid and CHIP, that extends to 2019. So that is effective upon enactment, that being March 23rd, 2010, and we are working on some guidance on those areas as well. But, of course, what we want to do is think more broadly and not just provision by provision. And so here are some of the areas where we think about not just putting Medicaid into health reform, but how do we put reform into Medicaid and ensure that Medicaid is a very high-performing program for its current beneficiaries as well as for our new beneficiaries that we will welcome in on 2014. These are some of the areas that we will be focusing on in the short, midterm, and long term. Eligible means enrolled. How do we simplify those systems and make sure everybody's eligible who ought to be eligible for as long as they are eligible? Access issues. We know that Medicaid generally performs quite well in terms of making sure that that Medicaid card translates into services, but we also know that there are areas of access problems, and we are looking at that and looking forward to working together with the new MACPAC commission that will be focusing on some of these access issues. We sorely need in the Medicaid program, no surprise to anybody, systems upgrades at the state level, better data measures at the state and the federal level. How do we measure our performance? How do we know if we're getting to where we want to go, both in terms of enrollment and quality? So we're going to put a lot of investment into those areas as well. And I think the whole healthcare system is really looking at payment and delivery systems reform, and Medicaid will be in the forefront of some of those payment and systems reform. Some of those demonstrations that Robin identified in the legislation will help us move in that direction. We are simultaneously looking very carefully at what the evidence shows in terms of what's useful for ways to deliver services as well as to pay for services in the most effective and efficient ways. We can't ever lose sight of the importance in the Medicaid program of the need to, we always put the rebalancing in quotes because we never really were in balance. So we are trying to get to balance in terms of our long-term care services. and supports and not neglect the importance of continuing to build up our community-based networks and supports and systems. And, of course, you can't be around town here and not notice that this administration is paying quite a bit of attention, as is appropriate, to the issue of program integrity, and we will continue to do that. So as we look at the Medicaid program and focus going ahead on the expansion and the under 65 population, again, I want to stress that Medicaid always needs to be very conscious of the fact that we have some very sick and some very high-need beneficiaries in our program, and we want to improve the quality of care offered to them. This slide gives an example of how our expenditures are so skewed because of the distribution of individuals with very high high health care needs versus other individuals. About 5% of all Medicaid beneficiaries account for more than half of all of our expenditures. We really need to do a lot in terms of improving the care that they get and perhaps affecting that cost curve while we're in the neighborhood. My last slide really leads to Vern's presentation, or I guess it's not my last slide, but it should be because my time is up. My nearly last slide is really a very important point that we are very conscious at the department that with all the activity that we have to undertake, with all the policy making that we have to do, we do not implement these changes. States implement these changes. And so this is to give you a sense of some of the things that we have to do, but we're very conscious that we need to do these very quickly around some of the changes that go into effect in 2014 because we are, as I like to think about it, sharing and then ultimately passing and then again sharing the baton with our state partners. So a lot of the changes that go into effect, the change in gross income, the change in asset test, the change in eligibility systems, we need to make our decisions and clear quickly and promptly in conjunction with states so then they can pick up those policy decisions and move and do their activities. So almost getting there. You would be surprised to hear me talk about Medicaid without talking about covering kids. So I just want to note that it is health reform is about covering everyone, and we, of course, did enact CHIPRA a year ago and are very interested in making sure that every single one of those eligible children are enrolled. We think that not only does right by children and by families in this difficult environment, but also builds the groundwork for health reform and making those systems work. The Secretary issued a challenge for me, for all of you, for everybody, governors, mayors, faith-based organizations, to get those kids enrolled, and we intend to do that going ahead. Now, for my last slide, I just want to recall to all of us who may feel a little daunted by the tasks ahead that Medicaid has an incredible history of stepping to the plate when this when our individuals in our country and when our healthcare system needed a boost, whether it was HIV/AIDS, whether it was people with disabilities increasingly going into the employment area and needing healthcare coverage that they couldn't get through private insurance, whether it was addressing the issue of infant mortality. Medicaid has consistently stepped to the plate, and we intend to be doing so in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. They didn't want to hear your last slide. They wanted you to keep going. Our final speaker, as Cindy alluded to, is Vern Smith, who will bring the other half of that federal-state partnership into clearer focus. He's a principal with Health Management Associates, a national consulting firm that advises states on, among other things, their Medicaid programs. He himself ran the Michigan Medicaid program under, was it four governors? More governors than I can remember from both parties. So he has some firsthand experience in how this stuff works at the ground level. And I'm pleased to say he is also a veteran of a few Alliance Kaiser briefings, and we're happy to have you back, Vern.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed, and thank you, Diane. It's a great privilege to be here today and to be on this panel with Cindy and Robin, and especially on a topic that's as important and timely as this is today. Clearly, when it comes to health reform, Medicaid is critically important. How this 50-state Medicaid programs do their part will in many ways determine how successful health reform is overall. In preparation for today, I've spoken with a dozen Medicaid directors to ask what's uppermost on their mind with respect to health reform. And what I've heard was, well, first, health reform is uppermost on their mind. But as they have gone through the law section by section to see where Medicaid is involved and it's throughout the bill, they've gained a great sense of the enormity of the task that's immediately ahead for them, which they describe as huge or daunting or challenging, or they just say the vice president was right. Already, states have formed task forces. Governors have issued executive orders forming, in the case of Wisconsin, for example, an Office of Health Reform led by the Secretary of Health and the Insurance Commissioner. Other states have done it different ways. Medicaid directors are involved. But the fact of the matter is states are already on the ground, and they're gearing up to run as quick and as fast as they possibly can. It's a big task, but they're up to it, and the reason that they're so excited about it is because there's so much at stake, and this is the kind of challenge that state officials are eager to jump into. Now, there are many challenges. The uppermost challenge is the new eligibility system. The law is going to require complete redesign of Medicaid eligibility systems in order to implement the new eligibility level at 133% of the federal poverty level. There are new definitions of income, the modified adjusted gross income standard. It is absolutely necessary for states to identify those who are newly eligible, and not just newly enrolled, but are eligible now because of the new standard, even though they may just be coming on. And this is an issue that states are stewing about. They're waiting for the guidance from Sunday so they can begin to write the system specifications and requirements and get on with this as quickly as possible. You know, if you have to determine whether they were eligible before and eligible now, does that mean you have to do two eligibility systems, the old one still and the new one? Somehow or another, this has to be done in such a way that it is done simply and efficiently. And I'm sure there's a way to do it. We'll figure it out so that it's done efficiently and makes the entire system better. The system also has to interact seamlessly with the exchange. Indeed, it's required that for an individual to receive coverage through the exchange, they first have to be evaluated for Medicaid eligibility. And so this has to work. And when we get done with this, there's going to be a new significant system here so that eligibility for the exchange, eligibility for Medicaid is all interrelated and works together quite well. It's a very complex system to change. And as one Medicaid director put it to me a couple days ago, his biggest concern is that people will think that 2014 gives us enough time. This is a huge change. And I've heard stories about how eligibility system redesigns in the past have taken 3, 4, 5 years to do, and this is bigger than anything in the past. So this is a very significant thing which is to be done. Now, it is important to be done in such a way that we can take advantage of technology to the maximum extent possible. There will be a lot more people on Medicaid. And reference has been made to the 16 million individuals. You notice that most of these come on in a relatively short period of time. And so there are going to be a lot more applications, not just for Medicaid, but people coming in to rule out Medicaid eligibility so they can purchase health coverage through the exchange. Now, there are other health reform-related provisions and decisions on the plate of state officials, and I'll just go through this very quickly, but there's an immediate decision about a high-risk pool if the state doesn't already have one. This is to be up and running by June 21st, so it's something to be done by the end of spring. Other systems changes related to the pharmacy rebate changes, the new formula, the fact that rebates are now available for prescription drugs prescribed for Medicaid enrollees in managed care, which was not the case before, so that's significant. States have to make a decision on whether they can expand eligibility early. As Cindy mentioned, it is, and Robin mentioned, it's an option available for states now. And they have to begin thinking also for the other changes, such as increasing the provider payment rates for primary care services in 2013. Now, it's not as though this is the only thing that's on the plate of Medicaid programs these days. They were already fully at capacity. There are health information technology projects, funds and projects from the Office of the National Coordinator. ICD-10 is coming by 2013. And now then, there are new opportunities for quality improvement projects, pilots, demos, and so on. And these are all things that states are excited about getting into. But the issue is that in today's fiscal situation, which is not expected to change over the next few years, state funds simply don't exist for the new administrative requirements that states have to deal with. And again, as another Medicaid director said to me a couple days ago, in a time of furloughs, layoffs, and hiring freezes across state government, I couldn't possibly ask for more staff. And so this is a very, very difficult time. And for states, this is just another reason why it is absolutely essential from their perspective that the enhanced federal matching that was in ARRA is extended for at least 6 months. Finally, there's long-term care. And this is a real – the changes in health reform and long-term care are so positive and so important from the perspective of state officials. One Medicaid director said, I am really excited to get started on this, to have better coordination between Medicaid and Medicare, to improve the care for dual eligibles, to improve the services that are available through home and community-based services. The incentives there, I think, are right on target from the perspective of state officials. So this is something that I think you can watch as there's further integration between Medicare and Medicaid, which is an important objective, I think. So finally, to sum up, Medicaid is facing and, I think, embracing a new expanded role in the healthcare system. Enrollment is going to grow by 16 million over the next decade. Medicaid budgets are going to grow. There's going to be an even greater share of state budgets. We're going to see the integration of eligibility systems with the exchange, some simplifications, better use of technology. There are going to be more efficiencies, better service, better care. But all of this is going to put Medicaid even more in the spotlight in terms of its role in state budgets. All of the pressures which are there now to control costs and not to have the budget increase so much faster than the rest of state government so that it draws resources away from other worthy state programs, they're all there. But as another Medicaid director said to me, reform has given us a chance to get it right. And I think you're going to see Medicaid directors across the country stepping up and trying to get this done and to do it very, very well. Perfect is the word I heard. Perfect.
Okay. And that's how we describe your remarks. And now you get a chance to be part of perfection here. Both the green cards in your packets, which you can fill out and hold up, and we'll have them brought forward. Also, there are microphones that some of you have already discovered, both in the front here and further back. I would ask you, those of you who do come to the microphones, to identify yourself, to be as brief as you possibly can, to give us a chance to get through as many of these questions as we possibly can. Yes, Carl.
Hey, Carl Pulser, American Healthcare Association. It's interesting to hear Cindy talk about a system, which is terrific, building a system. And what Vern talked about with the exchange having to interface with Medicaid, now all employers will have to interface in deciding whether they're eligible or they're vulnerable to fines or how they cover their employees. They have an incentive to get people onto Medicaid, lower-wage workers. And I was wondering, in terms of developing, and Medicaid is also going to be dealing with a whole new population, contracting with a group of people they're not used to covering as primary payers. So in terms of my question, in terms of building a system that has continuity, we have this boundary issue where you have, first of all, one group of employees will be in one kind of coverage and another might be in another kind of coverage. And if incomes change a little bit around those boundaries, there might be shifting back and forth from Medicaid to private coverage to Medicaid. So thinking about some rules for continuity over years And maybe I know some Medicaid programs have payments that make the employer-sponsored coverage now to buy Medicaid coverage through employers, but just ways that employees could have continuity of coverage along the borderline. Have you been thinking about that?
You're absolutely right. That's the three-legged stool isn't two legs, it's three. So we need to think as much as possible. Obviously, there are some more tools with respect to the integration of the exchange and the Medicaid program. The states will be administering both of those. But there are ways in which we can also think about blending and doing better around connecting employer-based coverage. We have some new provisions affecting ERISA in CHIPRA that help with open enrollment periods and try and bridge the gaps that people will feel when they go back and forth between private coverage and public coverage. And I think also to the extent that plan participation is more fully integrated across all three legs of the stool, the private health insurance, employer-based coverage, the exchange and Medicaid, then even as payment sources may change, then the disruption in care may be limited. So I think there's a lot of work to be done on that in many different areas, not just on the enrollment and renewal side.
Yes.
Indeed. Hi, I'm Kelsey with Congressman Raul Grijalva from Arizona, and I have two questions regarding the maintenance of effort requirements. First, do you anticipate states seeking waivers from these requirements? And second, when the maintenance of effort was placed on Medicaid in the ARRA funding, is there a reason that it was not also placed on CHIP?
I'll let others in the audience answer that. But as you point out, it is a difference between ARRA and health reform maintenance of effort provisions. ARRA applied only to Medicaid. It may be that there are different purposes in ARRA versus in the health reform legislation, so there is different reasons to think about why CHIP is in one and CHIP is in the other, but I won't put my my interpretation on the minds of Congress, and other people might be able to answer that. I don't know whether states will apply for waivers. We have not entertained any waivers, had any waivers in the ARRA maintenance of effort, and we have certainly not heard that from states at this point, and it'll be one of many issues I'm sure we'll consider going forward.
Can I just follow up? Cindy, there's a card question that actually raises something we were talking about beforehand. Given the maintenance of effort requirements, can you comment, and this isn't necessarily the new, others can chime in, can you comment on the decreased enrollment numbers that are projected by CBO for 2012 and 2013 that actually were on your slides, Mark? How did that happen? According to this, they were on your slides.
They were on my slide, actually, and I took that slide right off of the March 20th letter from CBO. My understanding is, we've speculated about this, maybe somebody else from CBO may want to comment on this, but it looks as though this is related to the economy and projection that under health reform that the economic situation would improve such that there would be a further drop compared to the baseline. Is that a fair sentence?
Sounds good.
So health reform is good for the economy.
Do you want to go to the back, Mike? Or?
I think we have this.
Okay.
Go ahead, Joanne.
Hi, Joanne Lynn. At the present time, with the advent of all this new coverage, it seems that it's a really interesting possibility to get some uniform assessments going. We have some in children with EPSDT, really none in commercial age populations, but maybe now we should. But the big issue, of course, is the disabled and elderly, where we're spending half of the dollars. And it seems that we've been at this for, 40 years, trying to get some kind of uniform assessment tool going. At the present time, we have MDS for nursing home and OASIS for home care and IRFPI for rehab facilities and probably a couple hundred different instruments in localities and states that are in use. it seems that this would be quite an opportunity to try to understand what this population really is in a way that can translate across settings, and that would be useful for comparative effectiveness work, be useful for administration of the program, comparing value across settings, and for the highly mobile patients who or clients who end up in different settings. But it isn't in the bill. Is there some move to try to get some convergence of the assessment instruments? CMS developed an instrument called CARE, which they then didn't implement, but MDS and OASIS are kind of moving toward each other. Maybe this is a real opportunity to get these already reported instruments in a position where they don't just trigger payment, but they also can be used much more effectively for quality and comparison purposes.
I mean, I'll just say generally we're spending a lot of time, as I indicated before, looking at data, data we collect, data we don't collect, but that the states already have. We are also, as you might imagine, in the context of the new Office of Dual Eligibles that will be created, looking very closely at how we can Medicaid and Medicare can be sharing data better with each other at the federal level, and certainly sharing that data in a more timely way. We've made some advances, but have more to be made at the state level. So I think all of your points are well taken, and it does provide an opportunity, I think, health reform to think about people and our ability to get some information about how we're caring for them in more consistent and thorough ways.
Diane? Cindy, in your comments about the seamlessness of Medicaid, the exchange, there's a question about how preventive services are going to be covered under Medicaid, and will that relate to the same benchmark coverage across the board? How will that all be determined?
Well, I think still to be determined, since the exchange benefit package still needs to be worked through. So there is a provision specifically that would make encourage states to adopt preventive coverage for adults in Medicaid. That's already a requirement for children. And I think there'll be a lot of attempt to think about how to connect the package in Medicaid with the package in the exchange, but there's still a lot of work to be done on that. Clearly, you see throughout the bill in many different areas, in terms of some of the demonstrations, the workforce issues, a real emphasis on prevention. So that'll be an area that we're going to spend a lot of time looking at.
And you have someone who also thinks you ought to add dental coverage for adults to the list of things that need to be considered, even though not in the legislation. Anyone? The mic in the back.
Yeah, James Cho with Congressman Ron Klein of Florida. One of the topics in healthcare reform that my boss thinks hasn't gotten enough coverage is the program integrity improvements to combat waste, fraud, and abuse. There are several provisions that he thinks are good. Probably we can go further, and to put in a plug, he filed a bipartisan bill, H.R. 5044, that would do that. But could you elaborate more on the program integrity improvements that would move us away towards the current pay and chase model?
If you want, I mean, I'll say briefly, and first of all, there's a tremendous amount of focus on the issue of program integrity. There was before the legislation was passed. It was an executive order that was issued on program integrity by the administration, and a lot of activities going forward. We had a summit, private and public payers together in January on program integrity. In CMS itself, we did a realignment that actually just went into effect a week or so ago, and that realignment created a new center for program integrity inside CMS and looking at Medicaid and Medicare areas to sharpen our focus, deepen our expertise, and to get the benefit of the learnings from both programs together. So Peter Bedetti is the new deputy administrator at CMS who is leading that office. So there's quite a bit of focus on it. You are absolutely right. There are many provisions in the bill that look at program integrity, require us to do some additional steps on program integrity. Prevention is what it's all about. We don't want to do pay and chase. We'll do pay and chase when we have to, but we want to avoid any expenditures of dollars that are not appropriate. And there's requirements around screening providers coming into the program, both on the Medicaid and the Medicare side. Those are some of the areas that that are in the bill that we're obviously beginning to work on implementation. So you'll hear a lot more about program integrity going forward.
And if I can just add one quick thing on that. From the beginning of the Medicaid program, there's nothing that's been more important than program integrity. You can talk about cost, you can talk about access, you can talk about quality, you can talk about a lot of things about the program, but all of them are dwarfed by the priority on a complete public confidence in the program integrity of the program. There's so much money that flows through Medicaid. It's a big program in state level, and every Medicaid director I have ever known has put a high priority on that, and all of these additional resources and strategies are completely welcome at the state level because it's essential.
Yes, Trish.
Hi, my name is Trish Niemar. I'm with the Center for Medicare Advocacy. I want to ask something about data, but first just a cautionary comment about program integrity. We find that vigorous efforts to curb abuse in Medicare, and I'm guessing this might show up in Medicaid as well, can often result in barriers to access. Providers get very nervous and they deny coverage, which is clearly ought to be provided on the theory that they will be somehow found to be engaging in fraud or abuse. It's a very tricky issue, and I just say that as a cautionary comment about vigorously enforcing fraud and abuse laws, which is obviously important. On the matter of data, when we look at Cindy's three-legged stool, there's a lot of data sharing that is going to be required to make the system seamless. And we know a little something from Medicare Part D, and also just from the dual eligibles generally in A and B, about the importance of real-time data sharing. We know, for example, that states are not required to share data with CMS on a daily basis, although they are permitted to do so. Most states, vis-a-vis dual eligibles, do not do that. It results in enormous delays when you have any errors in the data that need to be corrected. It results in a lot of problems for people, and we have made advances in the dual eligible area with respect to real-time data sharing and getting states to be receiving and sending data on a more frequent basis. And that has a very salutary impact on people getting the benefits they need. So I hope that as you develop these very complex data sharing that's going to have to happen to keep all of the pieces in touch with each other, that it's done on a real-time basis and that states are required to do that on a daily basis rather than once a month or three times a month. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Sean Grimminger with the National Association of Public Hospitals. And first, I want to say just how excited the nation's safety net hospitals are about the coverage expansion and the health reform bill generally. So take my question in that context. I'm interested in hearing how the administration anticipates or at least is going to take attempts to provide, if not coverage, access to care for the 20-plus million people who will continue to not have coverage after health reform is fully implemented, and not just undocumented immigrants, which is what most people think of, but also the homeless, the mentally ill, those who, you know, refuse to sign up.
Well, we certainly want to partner with you to make sure they get that care.
Those are
CBO's estimates. If you go along the theory that we're eliminating eligible but unenrolled, then people who are eligible but have trouble getting in the system up till now because maybe they are homeless or for other kinds of reasons, we need to think about it different. That's my new paradigm slide, is we need to think about different ways of making sure that there's multiple entry points, automated entry points, entry points that then allow you to maintain your coverage for as long as you're eligible. We need to, you know, turn the system around in terms of how we now look at eligibility and enrollment to make sure that every person's eligible. So we hope to do better than the CBO estimates, and we'll see how it goes. We, in conjunction with our states, obviously, they're the ones on the grounds that are doing this. But it will take a village, so this is not to then push the administration pushing it off on everybody else. But all of us, I think, need to really think very creatively about how we go about doing this and pool our ideas, pool our resources, and really make it happen. It's an exciting opportunity, but one that I invite everybody to participate in.
Robin, a factual question here related to resource requirements. They'd like to know how the policy is applied. Is it just to new eligibles? Is it to existing eligibles? The change in the asset test?
Oh, the change in the asset test applies to new eligibles. So individuals who are, there's still pathways for individual elderly and people with disabilities to come in under the old pathways for eligibility, which in some states still do require an asset test. But for the new eligibles, there's a requirement for states to shift to the modified adjusted gross income test with no asset and resource test.
Which, if I may add, is one of the complexities of the system, because someone might have qualified on the basis of income in the past, but not have met an asset test. And so they'll be new eligible, I think.
And can I just ask, how does the change in calculation of income affect this? I mean, is it going to be of a bigger importance than getting rid of the asset test?
Go ahead.
Well, I think what you're referring to is the change in the adjusted, switching to an adjusted gross income.
Yes.
I think that the Medicaid now operates by federal law, and some states operate a little bit differently by waiver, but it is a net income calculation to determine eligibility, and the new law says that as of 2014, virtually for all purposes, income calculations in the Medicaid program, except for people with disabilities, will and people over 65, will flip to a modified adjusted gross income. And the purpose of that goes back to the three-legged stool, is that is the basis for determination of eligibility for the credit, for the subsidy that will be available to people on the exchange whose income is right above Medicaid eligibility levels. And so the notion is that if you have one income standard across the two sources of subsidy, Medicaid and the tax credit, then you have a better ability to have a seamless system. But it is a massive change for the Medicaid program. It is one that we think will help make it not just blend in with the exchange more easily, but more simple to administer. If you think about Medicaid with all its categories and all its deductions, for people under 65, for non-disabled individuals, everybody will be eligible up to a certain level, regardless of categories, regardless of what state they live in, and it'll be pretty easy for families to understand what that level is because it'll be a modified adjusted gross income. But it's a major transformation that'll go on at the state level that we'll be working closely with states over the next couple of years to develop.
And just to echo, lots of states have determined income differently, so it will again nationalize the system as well as make it simpler. So all states will determine income the same way.
We have one more person who was in line before you, so if you continue to be patient.
Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Urenka from the Office of Congresswoman Melissa Bean of Illinois. Absolutely, Medicaid bigger and better, we can only hope, right? But I guess my question, I'd like you to comment on how we're going to pay for it regarding FMAP, whether or not this is time for FMAP reform. We're hitting the cliff from ARA, you know, plus up in December. We're hearing rumors about whether or not that's going to be extended. But I know back home, our hospitals are, for lack of a better word, freaking out about whether or not that money's going to go away. And now with more people and expanding to more people, I don't know, go for it.
Would somebody sort of review the bidding and make sure everybody's on the same page with respect to when the ARRA money expires and what the status is of the legislation?
I think any of us could do that.
Okay.
Well, the Stimulus Act provided a substantial enhanced federal matching rate for Medicaid that was effective beginning on October 1st of 2008. It extends for 9 quarters, I think, and under the law until December of this year. And when it ends, if it were to end then, it would be an incredible drop in funds that states have available to support their Medicaid program. And but that's when it's scheduled to end. There is a proposal to extend it for 6 months until the end of what is the end of the fiscal year for most states, which is June 30th of 2011. And that's what states are advocating for right now, and that's what hospitals are advocating for, and that kind of thing.
I'll just add that's what the President's been advocating for, too, as well. That's been in the President's budget, and the administration strongly supports the extension of the FMAP. We hope it'll happen soon.
If I could just expand on that, though. Even after a six-month extension, if that then goes away, Illinois right now has a match of 50%. They say that's completely unsustainable. We're doing constant gimmicks with CMS to try to rejigger and get more money back. Again, with that expansion, even if that's, you know, covered, that expansion's covered 100% for those first few years. I mean, what can I tell? I don't know if anyone knows Illinois politics. Our budget's awesome. But, you know, what do I tell our providers that come and say, we can no longer take these patients? We cannot. We are not getting paid. I mean, I don't know. Anything? Nothing?
Well, there's a lot that may occur. Certainly, starting in 2014, there is a considerable additional federal support available to states for expansions, and in some states for states that had previously expanded. So there's a vast amount of additional federal dollars. It isn't to say that states won't bear any costs. It's just a very significant additional support provided, and each iteration of the legislation as it moved through increased the support available to states. One of the things that I think we all need to work on going forward is how to make our system as efficient as possible. If we're, you know, that one of the things in the legislation is to not pay for hospital-acquired infections. Are we paying for emergency rooms where we shouldn't be paying for emergency rooms because people don't have access to primary care and preventive care? So that's the area that I was identifying before, which is service delivery reform and payment reform. That's where we need to focus on in order to make sure that every dollar we are spending is spent appropriately and as efficiently as possible. That's why we want to look at dual eligibles, in part its quality and its cost issues. That's why we want to look at some of the individuals with high cost, the high cost individuals. We think we can provide better quality care in the states that have been really moving forward. Is they can provide better quality care and often, not always, but often do so in more cost-effective ways. So there's the whole health system, I think, needs a lot of reexamining. There's a lot that's been going on in the private sector, a lot that's been going on in Medicare, and many states have been looking at these avenues, and that's where I think we have to be very aggressive over the next period of time.
Thank you.
Just to make one other point, looking at the short term, the reason why, again, the ARRA extension is so critical now is that states are making their decisions about their budgets for 2011, and right now that those funds would expire right in the middle of most states' fiscal year 2011. So while it's not a full extension till health reform, it does get states through their next fiscal year again, and states are making these decisions right now. Come 2014, there's also additional federal financing for people with new coverage, but there'll also be a lot of new coverage, so that means additional revenues for providers from coverage. So that's important to remember, too.
Hi, I'm Jen Stewart. I'm a third-year med student at Georgetown and also a member of the American Medical Student Association and Physicians for a National Health Program. One of my main concerns, obviously, is patients. I want to go into primary care, and I'm thrilled that access is increasing, that coverage is increasing, but also concerned about access issues, sort of related to what she was talking about. I guess with regards, I'm really happy that primary care physician payment rates were going to increase to 100% of Medicare. However, Medicare's physician payment rates are kind of, they've been an issue and in need of serious reform regarding relating to the SGR formula. So I was just wondering if you can kind of comment on how will this change, I guess, with or separate from the hopeful change in Medicare's reimbursement rates regarding the SGR formula?
I mean, the way the law is written is that it does tie the bump up in Medicare and Medicaid primary care provider rates to the Medicare rates. There's what may happen in terms of the changes in Medicare rates between now and then obviously will affect that. Okay. There's also going to be a lot of translation, I think, that we're going to have to do because there's obviously some services and some types of providers in the Medicaid program that aren't typically served in the Medicare program. So there'll need to be some extrapolation. Fully consistent, of course.
But according to the bill right now, how it's written, as Medicare payment changes, so Medicaid will be exactly the same?
It doesn't freeze in Medicare at any particular point in time, so it will be as
okay.
Medicaid is.
As it changes.
That's right.
Thank
you. In the years in question.
It also doesn't require states to not be able to set their own payment rates, so that one of the concerns is going forward, while we've got this economic downturn, rather states will actually be reducing provider payment rates so that the bump up will have to be even larger because that's one of the cost containment strategies. So you've got a lot happening between now and 2013.
And if I can just say, bless you for going into primary care. We need you and a lot more like you. In Michigan, our data show that over the next decade, 47% of the primary care doctors are going to retire. And we have a real shortage here, and there are other provisions of the bill that provide for measures to support the expansion of primary care within the physician community and other primary care providers as well. And this just underscores how important that is.
Anybody wants to help decrease tuition?
Hi, Rohan Bieslow with NCQA. I'm wondering if the panelists forecast an increase in Medicaid managed care, more states working with private HMOs to cover a larger portion of their beneficiaries. I'm wondering what that means for the future of the program with all these new adults coming in and what that means for QI activities that states now have the flexibility and the funding to engage in.
QI quality improvement?
Yes.
Well, if you look back over the last many years, couple decades, there's been kind of a constant improvement or a constant increase in the number of states that are using an organized system of care of some kind. Oftentimes, about half the time, that's a prepaid capitated risk-based health plan, an HMO, and that seems to be on the ascendancy. And that has especially been the case since 1997 when federal law changed, which allowed for Medicaid-only health plans. And so I would expect that, regardless of health reform, that trend is probably going to continue. And probably what that means, I would just speculate, that when Medicaid beneficiaries are in health plans, states have developed a good deal of expertise in writing contracts that hold health plans accountable for access, for quality improvement, oftentimes expecting, if I may say, NCQA or some other accrediting organization, some kind of badge of accreditation, which shows that they're actually capable of and are providing quality care. So I would say this is a good thing for the future of quality improvement, and I think that trend is going to continue.
Thank you.
Just as a data point, over 70% of Medicaid beneficiaries are enrolled in some type of managed care plan now. So we can assume that as states expand to these new populations, that they would continue to utilize those delivery systems of care for new people.
And Cindy, a related managed care question that goes with the drug rebates is how will the drug rebate provisions be provided? Will the states share in some of those savings as managed care becomes eligible for the drug rebate?
So the drug rebate provisions, there's a number of changes in drug rebate, and the rebate level itself was increased, and the increase in the rebate level for drugs that had been subject to a rebate, let's say, goes to 15% to about 23%. The share of that increase that otherwise would have gone to states is it does accrue to the federal government. But the other change in the drug rebate law is that for the first time, states will be able to get a drug rebate for drugs covered inside managed care organizations. That was never possible for states. So as Robin's data suggests, that's a big change and a big positive change for states in terms of their ability to draw down rebate dollars. So they will share the savings that accrues from that from the 0 to 15%, and then the additional increase will be accrue to the federal government. But it's a big change in terms of managed care with the rebates coming into managed care.
Hi, Doug Trapp with American Medical News. This is another one for Cynthia, but everyone else feel free to respond as well. I'm just wondering if you think that the bill has enough in it to guarantee access both for the old Medicaid enrollees and the new ones, you know, access to care. And specifically what I'm kind of curious about is the primary care payment, which of course goes up to Medicare levels, but then after 2014 apparently it just drops back to what it was before. Is there more needed on that front, you think, or anything else?
Well, it's similar to what Diane says. There's a lot between now and then that will occur. There's a lot of work that's going to be going on around access issues. We have a whole new commission that is getting started. So there's a lot of attention going to be paid to access issues. And the provision that you cite is just, I think, one element of going forward and thinking about what is being done now, what needs to be done going forward. The other thing to think about in terms of the federal dollars for the bump up in the primary care payment is that there will be significant additional federal dollars for the Medicaid program writ large. So the newly eligible individuals for the first 3 years, all their expenditures are fully financed by the federal government. So there's some new dollars in the system come 2014. There's going to be a lot of attention to issues around access and payment rates in the shorter term, as indicated by the commission and by the agenda that we have at CMS.
And while you noted that the requirement, it's 2013 and 2014 that the federal government helps pay for the differential, but the states won't be required to drop their payment levels back to the other levels. So hopefully, as those levels go into effect and the program monies that come in from new eligibles as well as coverage of the current ones, the system will be more sustainable and more able to afford that coverage. And I'd also add that there's also substantial expansion for community health centers and other providers of care in medically underserved areas. And I think the MACPAC and CMS will have to very carefully look at where these populations live and to what extent the individuals that we're trying to improve access for are coming from medically under-resourced areas, and there is much in the bill to help build back some resources in those areas.
Also, one of the things that we'll be doing is there's a number of states, there's about more than 10 states that now cover the so-called childless adult populations through waivers, and we're going to be pulling them together with some other interested parties for lessons learned about networks and reaching out and providing the right kind of care at the right time to to individuals in that population so that we can share that information with other states as we move forward and ensure that the right networks and the right systems are in place as we move forward to implementation in 2014.
Just real quick, I'm sorry. So after 2014, do you think that, this is for Cynthia, I suppose, do you think that there needs to be some additional, like to extend that beyond 2014? Is that what you're saying exactly?
Or no, I think I was making the same point that Diane was making, although she perhaps did it better, is that after there's, I mean, obviously Congress can decide to extend the bump up, but after starting in 2014, there are other additional sources of support for the Medicaid program. So, for example, for all the newly eligibles. So those additional the sources of federal support coming into states may make it possible for states to continue to provide the level of payments that they might have been providing under the federal law provision.
And if I can just add one thing, adding 16 million people to the system is significant, and there may be some access issues that need to be taken into account. But keep this in perspective. In the 1990s, Medicaid enrollment grew over that period of time by over 75%, and in the last 10 years, grew by over 50%. So what we're contemplating here under health reform is not unprecedented in terms of the size of the increase.
Before you go, I just want to let folks know, remind you that we are not running till 2 o'clock. We're running till 1:30, so time is getting short. If you really, really want your question asked, you should come to the microphone because Diane has a stack of about 116 cards here. And also take the time as we're finishing up here to fill out a little evaluation form out, if you would. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Dr. Donnell. I am chief resident of preventive medicine at Emory University School of Medicine. My question to the committee is specifically on the fact that $100 million in grants will be issued to encourage healthy behaviors based on the slides presented. Are these grants going to be federally funded, and will they be continuous in nature, or will the states have significant discretionary ability to decide the content of which those healthy behaviors are? The reasoning behind that is, over the states and the union, some states the issues are obesity prevention, which although is a national issue, some states are much more deeply affected, while in other states HIV/AIDS prevention is an issue, as well as STD prevention. So I wanted to know how much of the content do the individual states or community centers will have over deciding on what issues to prevent unhealthy behaviors?
Well, the 2 points I'd make is we haven't developed the policy for that demonstration yet, so still to be determined. But traditionally, the way we've approached grants and demonstrations like that is to fully recognize that we've got 56 jurisdictions implementing the Medicaid program, and there's a lot of variations, and our approach generally must and should take into account those variations. But we'll be working on that in the months to come.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Dan Vock, and I'm a reporter with Stateline.org. My question kind of dovetails with the access question. I was wondering, is there anything that you all are taking from the experience of Massachusetts, some other states that have, you know, done these near universal, I don't know, Vermont, Maine, or even all kids in Illinois, that you're now looking at for 2014 when this is rolled out? Is there anything that those states have taught you that other states should know about as far as physician access come 2014?
And I might add, it isn't just physician access in a lot of places. It's primary care practitioner access.
Right.
Well, certainly Massachusetts taught us that it's important to keep your eye on access to care and on the availability of the physician and nurse practitioner and community care clinic access. And I think that's why some of those provisions are built into this health reform legislation, as well as some of the demonstrations of how to do better coordinated care. So clearly, one of the lessons is that you don't just give people eligibility for health insurance, you have to make sure that there are services delivered on the other end.
But, you know, I think that's exactly right, and I think the legislation reflects those lessons in many respects. There's lots of provisions, as Diane said, to talk about more support for community health centers. There's workforce development investment provisions in the legislation. So the legislation itself, I think, contemplates that it takes more than just expanding eligibility to make this all work.
I would also just say we are doing some work with some of the states that have expanded to childless adults, and different states have different, not just enrolling them, but connecting individuals with a specific plan, and then how those plans connect folks to their primary care physician. You know, it's different in each state, but there's a lot to be learned. Also, some states are doing things like health assessments or requiring physician encounters in the first year of coverage. So there are lots of interesting things, I think, that are going on in states that, again, aren't part of the legislation, but lessons that we can learn.
Hi, Andrea Weddle with the HIV Medicine Association. And my question goes back to the Medicaid reimbursement rates, which does seem like such a critical provision in terms of improving access. And I was just wondering if there's flexibility for the primary care increase to apply to some specialists whose majority of the work is primary care. I mean, for HIV care, a lot of that's delivered by infectious disease specialists, oncologists, OB. I mean, it really, you know, covers the gamut, and just was wondering if there's flexibility there in terms of how much of their time and billing is for primary care for that to apply to them as well.
Well, but yeah, there is some flexibility. We'll be looking at the legislation and be glad to talk to people. I mean, as you know, there are many different kinds of providers and different kinds of settings that will be providing primary care, and exactly what the boundaries are, I think, for us to look carefully through as we get closer to that point of implementation.
This may be the last question. Trish?
That's the second one.
I know. I wrote this on a card, but with your caution about the card, I thought I should ask it. Is there a kind of generally recognized equivalency of 133% of FPL with adjusted gross income to a percentage of FPL under the current income disregards? This, obviously, the transition for people who become dual eligibles is going to be an interesting thing, and I know there's language in the legislation that allows for some working with that, but I'm just wondering if there's a generally accepted equivalency.
It doesn't apply to dual eligible, so. Right. The change to adjusted gross income doesn't apply to people with disabilities.
I know, but there are people who will be in the system through the new Medicaid
who might eventually
rules,
become
yes.
a dual eligible.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Sort of the pre-official disabled category.
Yeah.
Different states, I know I worked with New York, and they've done an analysis. They converted to a gross income. So we are going to be doing a survey and a study, we hope, of looking at the income levels and deductions that each state has and evaluating them to get a better sense of that. But there's such a variety, as Robin says, in terms of how states are now calculating income that I think it's not safe to give you any one conversion factor.
Okay, I think we've come to the end of our time. You've been extraordinarily helpful in eliciting a lot of different expressions and judgments and facts from our panel, and I want to thank you for that. I want to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation for being instrumental in both staffing this panel and helping the event come forward in the first place. And remind you that we'll be doing this with respect to private insurance next Friday. You'll have the announcement in your inbox when you get back. And ask you to join me in thanking our panel for an extremely useful conversation.
And I would just add that while Ed has talked about next week of private insurance, the following week is Medicare, and a lot of the issues about coordination of the duals that are questions here may well be things we'd like to see answered at that session as well. Thank you.
Good point.
Everyone can have questions.